backed away, frowning. Vivian's black eyes shot to him, then me, curious but too frightened or discreet to pursue it. Etta Halverson began waving her left hand. The smile had never left her face. Vivian said, "She does that." Milo said, "Maybe you can help us, Vivian. It's not really Miss Halverson we're interested in. It's a young man who drives a black Camaro that used to be hers."
"Corey."
"You know him?"
"Yes, sir."
"Is that spelled C-O-R-Y or with an E?"
"Don't know, sir."
"Last name?"
Weak smile. "Sorry, sir."
"How do you know Corey?"
"He's a friend of ma'am."
"A friend?"
"From working for her, sir."
"What kind of work?"
"Yard work, sir. Clean up. He also visited, sir."
"Back when ma'am could still talk?"
"Also after, sir."
"When's the last time he was here?"
Vivian's index finger stroked Cupid lips.
"Maybe 6 months, sir. I don't know, really, sir."
"Was he here to work or to visit?"
"Both, sir."
"Any idea why he stopped coming by?"
"Joining the army, sir."
"A half year ago?"
"Maybe a little more, sir. Or less. I'm sorry, sir, I don't know."
I said, "You're doing great. So Corey came to tell Etta he was joining the army?"
"Yes, sir. She did that, sir."
Pointing to the still waving arm.
Milo said, "Does she understand anything?"
"Food," said Vivian. "She eats 3 times a day. Also snacks. Her blood pressure is good, sir."
Etta Halverson's arm lowered. The smile endured. I said, "Vivian, how was Corey paid for his work?"
"Cash, sir."
"Who handles Miss Halverson's finances, paying her bills?"
"The bank, sir. They pay me, too."
"Which bank?"
"First Coastal."
"Are they around here?"
1400 State Street, sir."
Milo wrote it down.
I said, "How did Corey come to drive Etta's car?"
"It was her son's car," said Vivian. "Stuart. He died, sir."
"Sorry to hear that. When?"
"Before I knew ma'am, sir."
"Any idea how Stuart died?"
"She told me cancer, sir."
Milo said, "The car was Stuart's and Etta sold it to Corey."
"No, sir. She gave it to him. He was so happy."
She smiled as if to demonstrate. "When?"
"After the first stroke, sir."
"So a couple of years ago?"
"Yes, sir."
"She gave him the car because?"
"She didn't drive anymore, sir."
"Still, that's a nice gift."
"Corey helped her."
"Nice boy."
"Very nice, sir."
I said, "Does he live around here?"
The question seemed to genuinely perplex her.
"He rode a bicycle, sir."
"Before he got the car?"
"Yes, sir."
"You have no idea where he lives?"
"I'm sorry, sir."
"Anything else you can tell us about him?"
Another finger tap, this time covering both lips.
"He was always nice."
Her wristwatch beeped.
"Time for peach yogurt. Okay, sirs?"
"Of course," said Milo.
She left and returned with a carton and a spoon. I said, "Is there anything else you can tell us about Corey?"
"He plays that,"
pointing to the piano.
"Very good, sir."
I walked over and pointed to the sheet music. "Did he play this piece?"
"Oh, yes, sir. Very good. Stuart played trumpet, ma'am said."
"Professionally?"
"No, sir. Ma'am said he was a router man."
"A plumber?"
"A router man, sir. The drains. Ma'am's husband, too, sir."
"Router men. Any pictures of Corey here?"
No, sir.
She gave a start.
Oh, sorry. Yes, sir.
She looked at the yogurt. I said, I'll feed her. Her stare was skeptical. I promised to do a good job. Could you please get that photo? I spooned peach-flavored creme between Etta Halverson's lips. She licked them between each swallow. By the third time, her hand was clutching my wrist. Cold, thin fingers digging in. Strong grip. Vivian returned with a small color shot. Etta Halverson, looking exactly as she did now in her wheelchair, behind her a wall of shrubbery. Between her and the vegetation stood a young man in a black T-shirt. He'd smiled for the camera, but the downward cast of his eyes, focusing on the diminished woman before him, clouded the effort. Skinny, long-haired, zits. 2 years ago, I'd have taken him for 17, so maybe closer to 19 than early 20s. But otherwise, Henry Prieto's description couldn't be improved upon. I handed the photo to Milo.
Who took the picture, Vivian?
My friend, Helen. She's at night, sir.
Just the two of you taking care of ma'am.
2 weekends a month, Vera comes.
Who visits ma'am?
Headshake.
No one, sir.
No friends or relatives?
Stuart was her only child, she said, pouting.
She took the yogurt from me, and I unpeeled Etta Halverson's talon from my wrist. Vivian said,
Very sad.
Flash of white teeth, sway of long hair.
But we try to be happy, right, ma'am?
Outside, Milo re-examined the photo.
Corey No Name. She never asked why we were curious about him.
Probably intimidated by authority, I said.
Or, he said, she's covering something.
Or, I said, he really is a nice kid and she can't imagine him being in trouble.
Spare me nice.
A text jingled. Petra returning his of last night. She was home with a rotten cold. Raoul would recheck the CCTV for the other cars. He lowered the phone to his pocket. Before it got there, it began playing Saint-Saëns. Some site had cached French romantic music for the working detective? Sean Binchy said,
Just went over to the storage facility, Loot. They specialize in fancy antiques and art, and neither Wayland rents a unit, sorry. What I'm really sorry about is the captain's shifting me to some cold armed robbery assaults. 5 unsolved up and down Pico.
Go for it, kid.
Boring, Loot. Captain says this is the wave of the future. Low crime rate. Time to open up the worm cans.
Gotta have a sit-down with the bad guys, Sean. Tell them to get their felonious asses in gear.
We did door knocks at Etta Halverson's neighbors. Most weren't home. A few recalled seeing the blonde boy in the photo mowing the lawn, but no one knew his name or where he lived. As we headed back to the unmarked, Milo said,
Not that nice of a kid. Long hair says he's not in the army, so he lied to Etta.
I said, Or he tried to enlist and got rejected, or got in and was discharged.
You're everyone's defense attorney today? I woke up at 3 a.m. thinking about Wayland being my bad guy all of a sudden. I can't get it to settle as a solo deal, Alex. We're looking at a hell of a game of musical cars. The night of Braun's murder, he uses his truck to ditch evidence and trades for the Taurus, which he stashed in parts unknown. The night of Chet's murder, he stashes whatever he's driven to Hollywood, walks to the Sahara, pops Chet, abducts Donna, or whoever the woman is, and drives away in Chet's wheels. That's not enough. He drives to Arrowhead in the Rover, gets surprised by Brassing, and pops him, does the torch deal, and walks back to the A-frame. There's no garage there, so what's he driving now?
I said, 2 drivers could explain it.
Two drivers would sure as hell make it more feasible, he said. And who better for an accomplice than someone who's been seen skulking around both victims' houses? Who, on top of that, lies about military service, thinks registering a car is a suggestion, and rabbits when he sees Prieto watching him. That sound like innocence to you?
I said, he does play piano.
He laughed. There you go. Artistic license. Seriously, am I missing something?
You're making sense. And if Corey is a criminal, it could work in your favor.
How so?
Unsolid citizens are often known to the authorities. Detective Sheila Braxton was in her car. She said, need another phone number?
That was helpful, thanks. But no, I need info on a possible suspect I got via the number. Kid named Corey. 19 to early 20s, skinny, blonde, drives a black Camaro with 09 tags. You ever run into him?
She said, I suppose the age and physicals could fit if Corey's short for Cormac.
All I know is Corey.
Hard to see the Corey I'm thinking of as a murder suspect.
Nice kid, huh?
Nice enough, but it's kind of complicated, said Braxton. I'm on my way to lunch. You have time?
You bet. Where?
I was planning on Burger King.
Upgrade, Sheila. On me.
Well, that's nice of you, Milo, but not necessary.
Life's about more than necessity, Sheila. Name a place with tablecloths.
You into seafood?
Like a shark.
Braxton laughed. Cabrillo, just north of Stern's Wharf. New place, they say, is good. Moby Richard.
Cute, said Milo. They call me Fishmeal.
Pardon?
See you in 10.
Chapter 44. The Moby Richard sign featured a weirdly slim whale, a cetacean personal trainer. Checked blue oilskin tablecloths, black and white period photos on gray walls, raw bar to one side, open grill kitchen to the left. New place, but three quarters full.
Milo said,
there she is,
and headed for a typical cop's table. Rear corner, clear view of the action.
Sheila Braxton was in her 50s. Tall, pretty, with a wry smile and a mop of iron-colored curls. She wore a deep green crew neck, black slacks and olive flats, tiny diamond studs in her ears. Milo made the introductions.
She said, psychologist, crazy world, I'm sure you're always busy.
A waiter in a man bun and a waxed mustache came over and read off a long list of catch-of-the-day specials in a French accent. Sheila Braxton looked amused as she ordered scampi and a side salad. I went for grilled salmon. Milo said,
surf and turf.
Man bun said,
pardon?
Right here,
jabbing the menu.
Filet steak and Pacific lobster. Medium rare on the steak.
Combination two. Very good.
Take your word for it.
Pardon?
Merci.
Man bun pranced five steps and returned.
Drinks, please?
Iced teas all around. The waiter's second departure was durable. Braxton grinned.
You always liked that, Milo. Throwing people off balance.
Call me Lieutenant Sumo.
Lieutenant, congrats. And you're still working cases?
It's complicated, Sheila.
Braxton looked at me. I said, he threw the right people off balance. She was laughing as Man Bun brought the tea in jam jars. Took a sip and put hers down.
I was a little guarded on the phone because I see the individual in question as vulnerable. No, I haven't turned into a social worker. The case wasn't even mine. It was Bob Manning's. I was the secondary.
Milo said,
Big Bob. He finally retire?
He died before he could. To me. My mentor, doctor, used to be LAPD, moved here, and worked violent crimes.
Good man, said Milo.
Braxton said, the best. He took me under his wing when the female thing was a lot different.
Man-Bun brought bread. No one touched it.
Braxton said, anyway, I'll lay it out. Bob caught the case, and it got away from him. What we all hate, likely homicide, but no body. A darn good idea who the bad guy was, but no way to put it together. It stuck in Bob's throat, kept him on the job longer than was good for him.
Mission unaccomplished, said Milo.
He nudged me.
What's that technical term? Something with a Z? Freud's mark of Zorro, whatever?
I said, Zygarnik effect.
Braxton's eyebrows rose.
I said, tension for unfinished business.
She said, I'll have to remember that for parties.
Her tone said she wouldn't.
So here's the deal. 7 years ago, a teacher named Jacqueline Mearsheim disappeared. Married for the third time, one kid from the first, a 12-year-old boy. She was widowed the first time, divorced the second. Husband, too, was also a teacher who'd moved overseas, some oil country in the Mideast. He got looked into, totally out of the picture. Mearsheim was Hub 3, also worked for the school district, some kind of administrative job. He and Jackie met on the job, got hitched pretty quickly. A year later, he reported her missing. 3 days after, she failed to show up for school. His story was he wanted to give her space. She'd been depressed, had taken a couple of days to sort herself out. Conveniently, the son was also away during that time. Class trip to Sacramento. A busboy brought the food.
Milo said, 3 days after. Yeah, I can see Bob twitching.
Plus, Mearsheim gave him a bad feeling from the get-go. Too theatrical, crying, going all Mr. Sensitive, but no real tears. It seemed rehearsed. Add that to the obvious, he's the spouse and the last person to see her alive. Plus, no one else ever saw Jackie as being depressed. The final factor was the boy, Cormac Thurber. Yes, he was called Corey. Out came Milo's pad.
With an E or no?
C-O-R-Y. He ended up telling Bob his mom had confided she was going to leave Mearsheim because he had no human feelings for her.
I said, he ended up?
Quiet kid. Hard to get anything out of him, doctor.
That was his wording, no human feelings?
It was, said Braxton. I remember thinking it was pretty sophisticated for a 12-year-old, and something his mother might actually say. Bottom line, everyone, even Mearsheim, agreed Jackie would never walk out on Corey.
I said, Mearsheim's theory was a stranger danger thing?
Exactly, doctor. Snatched by the convenient, shadowy villain.
Was her car ever found?
Nope. And no charges on her card or ATM withdrawals. A super meticulous shadowy bad guy, right? Bob's gut said that was bull.
Milo said,
before we go on any further,
and showed her the photo from Etta Halverson's house. She took a while examining it.
I knew him when he was prepubescent, but if I had to bet, I'd say yes.
She cut off a nibble of scampi, as if eating was expected of her. Milo began sawing into his steak. No reticence there. I took my phone out, logged onto a pay-per-view yearbook photo site, and pulled up Santa Barbara High. Keywording Cormac Thurber brought up nothing.
Braxton said, what are you scanning?
I showed her.
She said, it's possible he didn't go to a regular high school. After Jackie's disappearance, he ended up in the foster care system, and when Bob ran into him a couple of years later, he was studying music and going to some alternative program. It was a comfort to Bob. At least the kid had something going for him.
I returned to the internet. Alpha Alternative School, Goleta. For working actors, athletes, musicians, or anyone benefiting from an individualized curriculum. 100 or so students. In lieu of yearbooks, faces had been collected each graduating year and cached for public use. The face I was looking for had appeared 2 years ago. I showed it to both of them. Milo said, "Our boy." Braxton said, "No doubt then."
"The foster system, Sheila? Stepdad bailed?"
"That's what I meant by part of the story. 6 weeks after Jackie disappeared, Mearsheim was gone, along with every penny Jackie had put away, including insurance money from her first husband's death. Supposedly, she'd signed everything over to him and left Corey with nothing. Bob found out later that Mearsheim had inquired about cashing out $100,000 term life insurance policy he'd taken out on her a few months before. But with no body, no payout. He was too smart for his own good." Milo said,
"Paul Mearsheim,"
unclasped his attaché case, and brought out the DMV shot of the man we knew as Paul Wayland. Braxton took her time. "He had a beard back then, but, yep, it's him."
"He's your suspect?
Amazing."
"He goes by Paul Wayland, and he works for the L.A. School District."
"The system working for our kids," said Braxton. "Unbelievable. So what's he done now?" Milo summarized.
"Unfortunately, Sheila, we've also got nothing solid."
"Multiple murder," said Braxton. "This is really ugly. So what's your interest in Corey?"
"His car was seen near the houses of both victims."
"You figured him for an accomplice?" "Uh-uh, Milo, I can't see it. There was no relationship between him and Mearsheim. Just the opposite. The bastard abandoned him." I said, "He could be seeking out Mearsheim to find out what happened to his mother." "If so, dangerous pursuit," said Braxton. I stood. "Be back in a sec." I found a quiet corner in the adjoining parking lot and pulled out my phone. Mary Josephina, M.J., Braun, answered on the fifth ring.
"Oh, hi. You solve it?"
"Working on it. How are you doing?"
"In pain, as usual," she said.
"Pretty bad a few days ago. It would help if I could clear up Hal's disability, but the government's being a butt." "Hope it works out."
"It's sure better."
"Can I ask you something?"
"What?"
"Did a young man in a black Camaro ever drop by your house?"
"Once," she said.
"When?"
"Right after Hal got..."
"A few days after you guys were here. He brought me some food. Said he was a friend of Hal's. Hal had tried to help him out. He wanted to help me back. I didn't eat it. Greasy burger. I don't like grease. Also, he made me nervous."
"How?"
"Twitchy. I had him leave it outside. Once he left, I threw it out."
"Skinny, long blonde hair?"
"Yeah."
"Did he say how Hal helped him?"
"I didn't give him time to say anything, sir. It was Hal on one of his missions."
"Why, you think he killed Hal?
I saved my life by keeping him out?"
"Not at all," I said.
"Whatever," she said. "I was smart not to let him in."
"If he returns, please let us know."
"If he returns, I'll call 911, said M.J. Braun. "I don't like strangers."
Mary Ellen Braun answered after one ring.
"Oh, hi. You solved it?"
"Still working on it."
"Oh."
Deflated.
"What's up?"
"Did Hal ever talk about helping someone in Santa Barbara?"
"No, I can't say he did."
"Did someone from Santa Barbara kill him?"
"We're trying to get a handle on his activities. Did he ever mention helping teenagers or one boy in specific?"
"He liked kids. I could see that," she said. "Not in a sick way. I hope you're not going there."
I said, "Not at all. Mary Jo told us Hal went on what he called quests. We're wondering if one of them might have put him in danger.
In Santa Barbara?
I can see him hiking there. It's so pretty up there, you never think of it as dangerous.
Then again, Hal was such a nice man, and look what happened to him.
I returned to the restaurant. Milo and Braxton looked up from their food. I told them about Corey Thurber bringing a burger to Mary Jo.
That nails it, said Braxton. He didn't do anything bad.
Not much confidence in her voice. She studied me. I said, I'm thinking Corey and Braun ran into each other up here. Nothing planned. Maybe just two people sitting on the beach or the pier. Corey opened up about his mom. Braun was a good listener and offered to help. Milo said,
help how?
Either locate Mearsheim, or, if Corey already had tried that, find Mearsheim and demand to know what happened to Jackie.
Braxton said, that would be crazy.
I said, Braun fancied himself a knight-errant.
He'd do that for a stranger?
I told her about the McDonald's incident, the tree, the snake, Braun going off for days at a time.
She said, living dangerously.
He confronts Mearsheim, it's lamb to slaughter. But why would Mearsheim leave his body in your second Vic's house? If we're right about Jackie, his thing was to conceal the corpse. I said, with Jackie, he knew he'd be the prime suspect. With Braun, there'd be no obvious connection, so no need to conceal.
Who'd suspect the kind neighbor who opened his doors?
We didn't.
Milo said, he's right, Sheila. Guy came across as total beta male. If he knew his wife was fooling with Chet, there'd be no shortage of motive for using Braun's body as an F.U.
You think he disappeared, Donna? Just like Jackie?
Waylon said she was visiting her mom. I'm going to try to find out.
I said, any idea what Corey's been up to for the last 7 years? She wiped her hands on her napkin and stood.
My turn to take a break outside.
She was gone for 14 minutes. During that time, Milo tried to reach Donna Wayland at the school district, but was waylaid by sadistic voicemail instructions devoted to keeping callers away. I picked at my salmon, and while on hold, he consoled himself with half a dozen Grassy Bay oysters on the half shell and an equal quantity of kumeyes from Mexico. Braxton returned, shaking her head.
No hint where Corey is. My contact at Social Services says he was a chronic problem for his foster families. 5 families. He kept running away. He also messed up in school, refused to study. Alpha provides home study plans, and a couple of the fosters are good folks who really tried.
I said, any drug history?
Not as far as she knows, Doctor. But that doesn't mean much, does it?
Milo said, smart enough to avoid the system, or lucky.
I said, or he stayed clean.
Braxton said, you're an optimist?
Milo said, all these years he refuses to see the light.
It would sure be nice to be that way.
I said, maybe piano helped. Something positive he could build on.
Hmm, said Braxton. Apparently he does have talent. My contact said one of the fosters had a piano, and each time she visited, Corey was playing and sounding really good. I hope you're right, Doctor. He's sure had a rough road.
When he showed up at Braun's house, it was to bring food to Braun's wife and to tell her Braun had helped him. But there was no indication he knew Braun had been murdered. In fact, I think he might have really gone there to find out where Braun was, but never got the chance.
Then why Arrowhead? Said Milo.
What if Braun had traced Donna and Chet there, and he wanted to warn Donna about her husband? Sheila Braxton said,
oh, geez, if Mearsheim ever found out, that would be nuclear explosive.
Milo said,
We need to find this kid.
Chapter 45. We parted ways with Braxton, cruised Cabrillo south, and parked illegally on the beach side as Milo ran searches on Paul Mearsheim.
Clean. Big deal. He stinks of con man. Who knows what his real identity is?
I said he's used Paul, maybe because that's his actual given name. Mearsheim morphing to Wayland could be identity theft of some random dead person. Or he assumed Donna's name.
Why would he do that?
Playing the beta to the hilt, letting her think she was in charge. The cars were in her name because he pled poverty. Meanwhile, he's got Jackie's money hidden from her.
Another wife disappeared.
Maybe this one can be found, I said. Brassing's murder could have resulted from his discovering something buried in that forest behind the A-frame.
I told him to stay away.
He thumped the steering wheel with the heel of his fist.
The place has to be processed. Let's see if Ahern's a man of his word.
We got onto the freeway, where he immediately ignored speed limits. Just before Carpinteria, with the road sun-brightened and nearly empty, he pulled out his cell, then lowered it as something to the right caught his eye. A CHP Dodge Challenger was parked just beyond a road curve on the western shoulder, blue ocean gleaming through the passenger windows, tan uniform at the wheel, aiming a radar gun. Geography providing a nifty little speed trap. Maybe Milo could have skated, maybe not. Professional courtesy between the highway patrol and city cops is unpredictable. He slowed precipitously. The Challenger's beefy tires rotating toward the highway said it was ready to pounce. Milo altered that plan by turning off onto the right shoulder and coming to a stop 3 car lengths ahead of the cruiser. By the time he rolled down his window, the trooper was out of his car, one hand on his holster. A quick flash of Milo's ID and a few pacifying words about heading to a new crime scene and not wanting to drive distracted turned the trooper contemplative. Milo consulted his phone.
Oh, man, this is serious. Multiple victims.
The chippy, young, beefy, sunburn ruddy, said,
Good thinking you're getting off the highway, Lieutenant. The law is for everyone.
Looking crushed, he swaggered back to his black and white and sat there as Milo punched in Ahern's numbers. Ahern didn't answer his cell or his desk phone. A desk officer said the lieutenant was out but wouldn't give details. Milo said,
Any word on a forensic analysis at...
No idea. I'll give him the message.
As we got back on the highway, Ruddy pretended to ignore us. At Oxnard, Milo looked around and speed-dialed. Nothing to report from Binchy, Petra, or Biro. He handed me the phone.
Look up the school district I called before. Punch it and hand it over. Please.
He weathered bureaucracy through Camarillo and well into Thousand Oaks. Hopping like a frog in a lily pond, transferred from one bureaucrat to another. Near Lindero Canyon, I spotted another CHP stalk and said so. He passed me the phone, and I pretended to be him with 3 LA Unified functionaries. Finally, a woman named Estrell said,
Neither person is currently employed by the district.
Did they quit or were they terminated?
I can't give out that information.
Could you make a theoretical guess?
I'm not sure I know what you...
It's important to find them. They could be homicide victims. Estrell said,
Really?
Really.
Well, is this being taped?
No.
All right, said Estrell. All I can tell you is voluntary leaves of absence have been known to take place.
How long ago, theoretically?
Well, could be a month, around.
Thank you.
Victims, said Estrell. That's bad. I handed the phone back to Milo. He said,
You should be me more often, amigo, though you would need to up your caloric intake. A month. So they both left around the same time.
I said, maybe Donna gave notice first because she was hiding from Mearsheim and prepping to run away with Corvin. Mearsheim found out and quit to go looking for her, finally nabbed her at the Sahara. Then he took her back to Arrowhead to finish her off, returning to the scene of her crime to mete out justice, but maybe not swift justice. Brassing's death says Mearsheim was up there recently. One good reason would be to have his way with Donna.
You think he tortured her?
Someone who could blow a man's face off, sever his hands, and take the time to stage the body in a neighbor's house is capable of anything. He had me speed dial Ahern. Still no luck.
Just like TV, he said, solved by the fourth commercial.
I said, by adorable things using whiz-bang DNA. He was quiet for the next few exits. Then,
that goddamn place has to be processed.
Chapter 46 No news by 10 the following morning. I had a custody evaluation scheduled, initial session with an 8-year-old girl named Amelia, buffeted by her parents' guerrilla warfare. She arrived with her father, a grim screenwriter with a history of depression. That alone wouldn't prejudice his case. His ex, a former model, had been in and out of rehab. Amelia held his hand, but pulled it loose when she saw me. Chubby, ginger-haired kid with gray, war-orphan eyes. Tear streaks down her cheeks had dried to salty granulation. Her father said,
You need to know, she didn't want to come.
I bent and smiled, made sure to talk normally, not with that saccharine, I'm-so-sensitive shrink voice amateurs use. Hi, Amelia. I'm the kind of doctor who doesn't give shots. We won't do anything you don't want. Her mouth twisted.
Grim said, I just got her a dog, and she wanted to bring it. I told her it was against your rules.
What kind of dog do you have, Amelia?
Grim said, Maltese mix, as if letting out a state secret.
What's your dog's name, Amelia?
Whispered reply. I bent lower to catch it as Grim said, Snowy.
You can bring Snowy next time, Amelia.
Grim said, Speaking of which, how many next times are we talking about?
Amelia, do you like all kinds of dogs or just Snowy?
All kinds.
Any allergies to other dogs? I asked Grim.
Not that I know so far. She's into Snowy, not dogs in general.
I said, Hold on for one sec, Amelia. Left and returned with Blanche trotting at my side. Gray eyes expanded like a water lily encountering sunlight. Amelia said,
Wow!
Her father said,
Do I wait here or out in the car?
An hour later, a perked-up, affectionately licked Amelia was hugging Blanche near the front door as Grim tapped a sandal.
Gotta go, Emil. Meeting at Warner Brothers.
He reached for her hand. She touched his fingers briefly, dropped her hand to her flanks. I said, Next week, same time, with or without Snowy.
Grim said, Hope this doesn't drag on.
Amelia smiled at Blanche, then stooped and kissed her. Her father waited for a while as child and dog communed. Just as I finished charting the session, my private line rang. Milo said,
Ahern finally called.
The A-frame got processed. A beat.
In the process of being processed.
Great.
Not so simple. Not... How's your schedule?
Just got free.
I'll drive. You can look out for radar guns.
He picked me up 4 minutes later, meaning he'd called while driving over, confident of my answer. I got in the unmarked, had barely closed the door as he sped off. I said, a few minutes earlier I was in session.
You some kind of doctor?
He told me why we were driving to Arrowhead. We spent some of the ride talking, most of it in silence. We reached the A-frame by 1:15 p.m., asked for a hearn, and were directed to the house's rear deck. The San Bernardino lieutenant was mid-50s, stocky and barrel-chested, with a shaved, freckled head and a bristly white mustache. He wore a white shirt, gray slacks, a blue tie, and black lace-up military boots. The body, lying face up in the grass, wore a navy shirt, jeans, a tan tie, and brown walking shoes. Male, around the same age as Ahern, tall and long-limbed, with a heavy-jawed face blued by stubble. He'd been shot once in the left side of his chest and once in the right cheek. Sidearm still holstered. Taken by surprise. No problem identifying this victim or estimating time of death. Sheriff's Detective Roger Livingston had been sent by Ahern at 9 o'clock this morning and ordered to stand guard pending the 10 a.m. arrival of the crime scene techs. He'd logged his arrival at 9:18, had recorded nothing further. At 10:44, a two-person team from the San Bernardino lab showed up, delayed by a street-clogging truck collision on the north side of the city. Livingston had checked out a squad car from the motor pool and parked it at a careless slant in front of the house, forcing the techs to walk around the black and white in order to reach the front door. They rang the front doorbell, and when that brought no response, circled around back. Techs are unarmed. The panic these two felt was understandable. Fleeing to their van, they drove a quarter mile and called in. Now they were inside, working their phones manically, waiting for the coroner's investigator to release the body so they could move from Livingston to the house. In San Bernardino, the sheriff is the coroner, and CIs are uniformed deputies. On duty this morning was Deputy Sandra Kolach, 40 or so, square-faced and stunned. She'd been held up by a gang shooting, had entered the scene just before Milo and me. She went through Livingston's pockets. No phone. Ahern said, "Got it in my car, Sandy. It was on the ground out back, so I bagged it." Breach of procedure. Kolach nodded, took notes, and shut her eyes. When they opened, she looked defeated. It's different when making an ID isn't necessary. The basics accomplished, she stood, said, "Sir," to Ahern, and left. As if part of a meticulously choreographed review, two morgue attendant techs appeared with the collapsible morgue gurney, a contraption I've seen so many times, but always find jarringly efficient. They worked fast, slipping Livingston into a body bag, zipping and loading. Ahern watched, eyes dry and bloodshot. His mustache did a poor job of concealing a lip tremor. Milo said, "So sorry, Al." "He must have walked right into it." Ahern clenched both fists. "I sent him 'cause I figured it was a piece of cake." Grinding his jaws. "I figured it was something he could handle." Milo said, "This was an ambush. No way to know." Ahern said, "Watching an empty house? What could be more Mickey Mouse?" He headed out of the yard toward the driveway. The three of us stood by as the gurney made contact with the butt edge of the van's rear compartment and snapped flat with a cruel snick. Body straps were checked, rear doors slammed shut. The van was gone. Ahern said, "I had problems with Roger. Not my sharpest blade in the drawer. An empty house, and he was armed, for God's sake." Moisture had collected in the corners of his eyes, turning the bloodshot vessels maroon. Milo said,
"No way to know, Al.
Try telling that to his widow. Like she could ever admit he was an idiot.
Oh, screw it, I'm not gonna blame him.
Could have happened to anyone."
We said nothing.
Ahern said, "It was so Mickey Mouse, I almost sent a rookie. Could have been Ramona."
He eyed a dark-haired deputy standing on the deck. Easy pass as a high school junior.
"She has no idea how lucky she is. Sorry we didn't process when you first asked, Milo. That was Roger, too. Sometimes he got like that. I'm not going to make excuses, but it gets insane down in the city. Don't know about your situation, but the gangs here are multiracial. You have no idea who you're dealing with."
A click rose from his throat.
"You think you're suspect? Mearsheim did this?"
Milo said,
"If we're guessing right, he's got no problem killing people."
"So that's how many?" said Ahern.
"My two male victims, Brassing, your guy, probably his first wife, maybe his second. Or she's his third or fourth, who knows?"
"A psycho. Shit.
Someone was keeping house here recently. I did a walkthrough. There's coffee, cereal, milk, lunch meat. Not a lot of grub, nothing that looks the long haul, and beds are made. Don't worry, I booted and gloved, didn't touch a thing. If there was visible blood, it's been cleaned up. I think I did smell some bleach near the kitchen. How is the traffic coming in?"
Sudden injection of trivia as a pathetic distraction. Milo said,
"Not bad. When we were here, there was none of that. Whoever did it came back recently."
Ahern said, "I was planning to have a sit-down with Roger tomorrow. Suggest he think about something else. Maybe detective wasn't his thing. I was going to go easy, but also firm. Our kids go to the same school. You really think you've got a Manson on your hands? I mean, the other alternative is what, a random psycho squatter? Sometimes we get that in the rurals. Cabins and lean-tos and hunter's blinds that aren't used much. You're a homeless, why not? Here, in the nice neighborhoods, what we get is burglaries. But from what I saw, no sign of break-in and no obvious toss."
The crime scene techs left their van and came toward us, carrying equipment cases.
"Okay to continue, sir?"
Ahern said, "I might have smelled bleach near the kitchen, but do the yard, too."
I said, "Any sign more than one person was here?"
"I didn't observe on that level, doctor. Just did an in-and-out looking for obvious. Why?"
"Looks like Mearsheim abducted his wife. Bringing her back here made sense if he wanted to humiliate her."
"Humiliate her how?"
"Same place she stayed with Corvin."
Milo said,
"Like I told you, they also shacked up in hotels, but hoarded a hostage in the Hilton."
Ahern said, "Humiliate.
You're thinking ultra-nasty happened here. Shit."
He showed us the spot that had been found. Shallow depression beginning to fill as the grass perked up.
Ahern said, "Cadaver dogs are good, but we both know they're not perfect. They don't find anything. I should probably still dig."
"I would."
"Unbelievable," said Ahern. "From bad to worse."
Milo said,
"There could be evidence back there on the neighbor's property."
Ahern's eyes shifted to the forest.
"That's a rich guy. Request to disrupt a fancy property? Can't wait."
I said, "Did anything interesting come up on Livingston's phone?"
"He called his wife when he got here. Knowing Roger, he probably fell asleep in the car, decided to take a stretch out back, and got surprised.
Way he blocked the door with his cruiser, the bad guy might have felt he was being hunted."
"Makes sense."
He sucked in breath.
"Roger was a regular guy. You can't be regular and do what we do, right?"
Milo said,
"Ain't that the truth?"
I said, "No streetlights. Must get pretty dark at night."
Ahern said, "With no stars or moon, it's a total blackout. You're figuring your boy's been coming and going at night?
Maybe when Brassing surprised him. Any idea what time of day that happened?
Still waiting on the pathology, Doctor, but you've got a point. For sure, Brassing was shoved off that cliff in the dark. That section of 18 isn't always traveled heavily, but there's always some day traffic. You couldn't count on not being seen.
Milo said, a fire would be more visible at night, but no one reported any.
Ahern knitted his fingers and cracked his knuckles.
If it was timed right, 2, 3 a.m., put the car in neutral, soon as it starts rolling, toss the match, it could have been mostly shielded from view. And the arson guy says the fire was brief, not successful if evidence destruction was the goal. Most of the scorch marks were in the rear section of the rover, and that's where they found the accelerant splashes. The body was damaged, but not burned up, so it weakened as it moved forward. I'd still bet on a night thing.
He unfolded his hands, stretched a few fingers, and produced more pops.
Something's bound to come up.
Milo said, you're an optimist.
I'm a realist, or as my college son says, a surrealist. Whatever that means. Kid wears black, is writing one of those plays where they dance around like who knows what.
He laughed.
Kid used to like football.
One of the techs emerged.
We smell bleach, Lieutenant, but so far no visible blood or bloody swabs. But there's a lot of area, and with all the glass and no drapes, it's too bright for luminol.
You'll do it after dark.
Someone will, sir, the next shift.
Don't want any communication issues, said Ahern.
There shouldn't be any, sir.
The tech returned inside. Ahern faced us.
It's all about communication, right? That's always what goes south. So, what else should we talk about?
Milo said, who does what?
One of ours goes down, it's ours. We'll handle everything in our jurisdiction.
Fair enough, Al.
No one will screw up.
He walked us to the unmarked, specified his plan. Nervous, like a kid delivering an oral report. The house and yard would be processed to the nth, including the use of infrared sensors and cadaver dogs. The neighbor to the rear would be contacted, and if an informal request to process the forest wasn't granted, a request for a warrant would be submitted to the best judge I can find. Ahern would also make sure all the hotels where Chet Corvin had stayed would be re-contacted about sightings of the Waylands. I said, expanding to some of the nearby motels might be a good idea. Ahern's glance at Milo said, this one's full of ideas. Like the true friend, ace detective he is, Milo said, he means the whole synchrony thing. Mearsheim did Corvin in a cheap motel. Maybe he stalked him at others, but the situation wasn't right.
Ahern said, cheapy dump. We've got our share of those. I'll try. Anything else?
Milo said,
be on the lookout for Corey Thurber, the kid in the Camaro.
You see him as a suspect or a potential victim?
At this point, victim makes more sense. But Mearsheim's likely to have an accomplice, so who the hell knows?
I said, with Donna out of the picture, the accomplice could be the new woman in Mearsheim's life.
Ahern said, he trades them in, huh?
Milo said,
more like sends them to the wrecking yard.
Chapter 47 Milo fidgeted as he raced toward Arrowhead Village.
Not sure what that accomplished.
I said, at least the house will finally get worked. 3 miles passed before he spoke again.
7 years between Jackie and Donna.
Good chance of someone else, I said.
When did he marry Donna?
Good question. Call Mo, see if he can find out.
I phoned Reed, got voicemail, left a message.
Try Sean.
Same result.
Milo said,
it's like everything's turned swampy and just walking's a hassle. Try Petra.
The third time wasn't a charm. Without waiting for further instruction, I phoned Raul Biro. He said, "You're on the Lou's phone, Doc. He's into safe driving."
"Driving from where?"
I told him. He said,
"A cop? Oh, shit. And you think it's the same guy who did the handyman, Wayland?"
"Best guess so far. His real name's Mearsheim. Maybe."
"Whatever his name is, I might have something. When do you plan to be back?"
"Couple of hours."
"That'll work," said Biro. "Got someone you'll want to meet. Listen to this."
Fueled by the news, Milo sped well past the limit, making adventurous lane changes, and when we reached the jam near the four-level downtown interchange, used the shoulder to press his way onto the 101. Ignoring honks and dirty looks, he said,
"Goddamn pretzel, and they don't even give you salt."
Squealing exit followed by more creative driving on side streets. When we pulled up in front of the Hollywood station on Wilcox, Biro was waiting. GQ'd, as always, in a light blue suit, white shirt, Windsor-knotted paisley tie. But the look in his eyes was anything but composed. He remote-opened the staff lot and sped ahead of us as Milo sandwiched between two other sedans.
"Thanks for sticking with it, Raul."
"Petra's idea," said Biro.
"How's she feeling?"
"Sick as a dog. More like a flu than a cold."
Biro looked at his watch.
"You made it unbelievably fast."
"Luck," said Milo.
Biro said, "I'll bet."
His right foot moved up and down as he scanned the street.
"A little late. He doesn't show up, I know where to find him."
A minute later, a white taxicab trimmed in blue and red approached from the south. Prestige cabs above a medallion impressive enough for a minor European functionary. Biro pointed the cab to the staff lot, remoted it in. By the time the cab had parked, we were at the driver's door. A short, wide man in a gray cardigan got out. 60s, sparse white crew cut, topping a face that looked as if it had spent years in the ring, a physique designed for trudges across the steps. Biro said,
"Hello, Mr. Grinstein. Thanks for coming."
"Boris,"
said the driver. Milo extended his hand.
"Lieutenant Sturgis, thanks for taking the time, sir."
Boris Grinstein hesitated before shaking, as if concerned about digit theft. His fingers were cocktail franks.
"The police say come, I come."
Bassoon voice, Russian inflection. I flashed back to a record favored by my educated Aunt Edith, Peter and the Wolf. Biro said,
"We really appreciate it, sir. You brought what we need?"
"Yeah, Lieutenant."
"He's the lieutenant. I'm just a lowly detective."
Grinstein's face compressed, taking on the look of a cabbage left too long in the fridge. Milo said,
"He's being modest. He's a commissar."
"Ho,"
said Grinstein.
"Commissars we don't need."
He key-opened his trunk, took a while finding what he was looking for among piles of laundry and Cyrillic-lettered magazines. Finally, he handed Milo several loose sheets of paper, dog-eared and stained by what looked like tea. Logs, written in a shaky, old-world hand.
"A week of driving I brought you," he said. "Company made me photocopy before I give you."
Biro said,
"Is there more than one pickup for the same client?"
No, one."
"You brought all of this because..."
Grinstein gave a sour look.
"With please, you do more than they ask."
Milo flipped pages.
"Okay, here we go."
Pointing to the bottom of one sheet. 9 p.m. call, the night of Chet Corvin's murder. The client, Mr. Korabin. The destination, Whiteley Avenue, just south of Franklin. Walking distance from the Sahara. Milo said,
Mr. Corvin.
Yeah, Lieutenant, said Grinstein.